Well, good morning. My name's Dori Zinkand, and I'm the principal at Tall Oaks Classical School, which is an Association of Classical Christian Schools member school in Newark, Delaware. And Newark is in New Jersey. Newark is in Delaware. I had to learn when I moved there. Most of my teaching experience has been in first and second grade, although right now I'm teaching eighth grade, and I've taught some high school. But I've been in classical Christian education since probably 20 years now, close to our school started about 15 years ago, and I was homeschooling some before that. I've done a combination of homeschooling and day school, so kind of got a broad background there. So I want to do an introduction, is what this is an introduction to classical Christian education. I suspect all of you are in it a little bit already. So maybe this is a time that we can not just do the basics, but think a little bit more deeply about the philosophy of what we're doing and where we're going with it. So I hope to accomplish that today. I think it's always important before you dive in to always have a good idea of where you're going and where you want to end up. And as we think about classical Christian education, we need to think about what our goals are. What is it we really want to accomplish with education? The view of education in our time in this culture is a lot different than it used to be. And as we remake something that once was, we rebuild these ruins, as Doug Wilson says, then we need to know what it is we're rebuilding. So let's start there, and then we'll talk more, we'll talk about the Christian end of it, and we'll talk then a little bit more about the classical end of it. So I think it's important that as you understand the philosophy that you build on, that you think about this is why I say patchwork instead of tapestry. When we started our school, we started a little bit too fast. If there was something we could redo again, I think it would be to take a year and regroup and see where we wanted to go, where we wanted to build. Rather than a patchwork, oh, we'll take this for history, we'll take this for English, we'll take this for math, this works, you know, I heard this one's okay, and put it all together in a patchwork form, it's better to start out, think in terms of a tapestry. You've got a warp that is the foundation that holds everything together. Then you've got your curriculum and everything that supports, that's building on that firm foundation so you know where you're going and what you want to accomplish. And that's the order it needs to go in. Okay. So let's talk about biblical mandates for education. Ty said, reminded us of the catechism question, man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. We want to equip our kids for the Christian life. Deuteronomy 6:4-9 says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children. You shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." And, of course, Christ in Mark 12:3, he was asked, which commandment is the most important of all? And he quoted that commandment. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. And so the object of our education then is not simply to fill the mind of the children with information. Okay, it's training their affections also to love God. It's training them to seek after the object of their affection with the meditation of their hearts, powers of their intellect, and the work of their hands. And we do not embrace the narrow view of education to which the rationalism of our age would bring us, that is, just to train a child for a job, okay, but to train them to be wholly human, the spiritual and the material, the revealed and the discovered, the dialectic and the poetic, all these must be trained and trained toward God. This verse also tells us that we're to teach a child when we sit in the house, when we walk by the way, and all that. And this is speaking not only to our faithfulness in regards to time, but also in regards to application. Okay, this is not a command to multitask. You know, talk about God while you do the dishes. Talk about God. You know, that's it. It's not that. It's to talk of heavenly things while we mindlessly do earthly things. It's saying that the word of God applies to everything, at all times, and this is the worldview that we need to raise up in our children. Okay, these verses speak to a Christian cosmology that, for practical reasons, we have to divide the curriculum up into subject areas. But the creation that we study is not so divided. Okay, God has created a universe, not a multiverse. Okay, and R.L. Dabney wrote, "Since all truths converge towards God, he who is not to name God must have all his teachings fragmentary. He can only construct a truncated figure. In history, ethics, philosophy, jurisprudence, religious facts and propositions are absolutely inseparable." So the word of God is at the center of the curriculum. And a lot of people talk about this, the word of God at the center, and then the subjects or spokes that come out. I'd say it's more like a web. They're all interrelated. History has a lot to do with art, and art has a lot to do with music, and music has a lot to do with math, and math has a lot to do with science, and all these things intertwine more as a web than of a spoke. So, and just God just permeates it all in his truth and his glory and his order. So as we, you know, as a practical matter, as we teach in school, we have to divide things up into subjects to some extent. But as much as possible, we need to repair those fragments and divisions within the curriculum to get what is more true. Okay, another biblical principle I wanted to bring out was the dominion mandate and the Great Commission. The dominion mandates in Genesis 1:28, and on the day of their creation, God charged them to subdue the earth and take dominion over it. And if you listen to the Great Commission in Matthew 28, you hear a similar, go out and make disciples. So there's this, now God has, after the fall, tainted man's work at the beginning. Now we have the redemption, and Christ gives us a role in the redemption. And that's an amazing thing. He gives us a role in the redemption, his redemptive work on earth, as we go out and disciple the nations. And so it's a wonderful thing. Then that is part of what we're equipping our kids for. I want to give you a Greek word. This is the word paideia. I want to talk about what paideia meant to the Greeks, and then we can talk about what paideia means in Scripture, because there's a very astounding use of it, really, in Scripture. To the Greeks, paideia was their system of education. And it was the education that was given to the free Greeks, not to the slave class. The slave class was given vocational education. They were trained to, they were taught to read and write if that was necessary, and then they were taught to do a job. Think about that. How do we train our people today? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the class that were free, that the rulership was expected to come from, the citizens that were expected to vote and make decisions, etc., they were all given a paideia education. Paideia education, one thing it did was it trained the mind. They started with all the wonderful Greek heritage, Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, Euclid, and trained their minds to think systematically, to think clearly, not to be muddled, teach them to speak well. They learned the poets. They learned to be Greek. They were taught virtues through Homer and through the playwrights, and they were inspired. They learned to love goodness, learned to love what is right, learned to love being Greek. And so it was a training, not only a strict discipline of the mind, but also a training of the moral imagination and a training of ethics. And this was to equip them to be citizens in their culture, but also, you know, they had some democracy. There is, you know, democracy within slave class coexisting, but the leadership wasn't necessarily inherited. It was came from the most able. And so this was training up this whole class of people so that the most able might rise and be good leaders for the society. Okay. Now, and I said that I give you that as background. You've heard Ephesians 6:4, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Or you might have heard training and admonition. You know, if what Paul says is paideia. Bring them up in the paideia of the Lord. What's he saying? All Greek, Scythian, slave, free, Christians are ruling class. You're to be brought up to lead. We're to bring up. So, I mean, Paul was not speaking just to free citizens of Rome. He was speaking to all the Christians. Fathers, don't provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the paideia of the Lord. So what is then the Christian paideia? You know, what is it that, you know, they have Homer? Well, we have Homer, you know, we still have Homer too. We've also got Daniel. Want to teach them about courage? You know, Daniel, David. You know, so we have our own body there, of our own canon, so to speak, from which to draw. And so the importance of training the mind to lead so that the most able might emerge from our culture, from our kingdom, to be rulers in this work that Christ has given us to do. It really, politically, that's really a charged verse. We don't get that when we see it, but it is a politically charged, because he was saying all these, the Christians to whom he was writing were part of another kingdom that was above. Okay. Also, I think it's very interesting that in this verse, paideia is held in contrast to provocation. Do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the paideia of the Lord. An ethic, a moral imagination that comes out of a paideia type of education. You embrace it. You cling to it. It's become part of you. You make it your own. Do that. You know, I'm not saying we don't have rules and guidelines for our children. Of course, we have to, but we want to train them to love the good things of God, to love what is good, to love what is right, to love using their mind, and that's the opposite. But really, that's not the case. In fact, I teach eighth grade reading right now. Reading is what separates lifelong learners, adults, I think, lifelong learners from those who are not lifelong learners, I think, is the ability to read well, the ability to pick up a book and analyze the flow of an argument, to find the organization that the author used to write that work, to be able to dissect the argument and to analyze it. And that's not a skill that you can teach a fifth grader. They're not ready for it yet. That's a logic level at least skill. So that's one of our goals. They need to be able to write well. They need to be able to present an argument and persuade. They need to be able to manipulate data, understand statistics, and calculate. So these basic mathematical skills. But beyond that, those are the general tools. We also have the tools of the disciplines. The different disciplines have different tools that, in order to operate on a rhetoric level, the students need to be able to be familiar with. Now, I'm not saying that by the time they finish 12th grade, they ought to be operating in a rhetoric level in all of these disciplines, but I'm saying they need to be familiar with the tools of the disciplines. Let's take an example as, say, science. You know, what does a scientist do? Well, he asks questions. He sets up experiments that control variables. He reports on what he has learned. He analyzes data, looks at it statistically, analyzes the data. He publishes in a peer-reviewed journal. He peer reviews the work of others. Okay, so our students ought to be familiar with what scientific journals look like. They ought to be familiar with the format, the way they papers are submitted. So that's kind of the thing. Doesn't mean they're operating at that level when they graduate, but they've got to be familiar with those tools so that when they go out there, if they're led that direction, they have the background. Same thing with a historian. What does a historian do? He doesn't read textbooks, memorize information, and write it back for a test. Okay? A historian looks at evidence, looks at documents, looks, you know, puts things together. So that kind of analysis, publishes again in peer-reviewed journals. So these are the kinds of things we need to be making sure that by the end of high school they've had at least some familiarity with in all the tools. Okay. Epistemology. Epistemology is philosophy of knowledge, philosophy of learning. Okay, we can think of the trivium as an epistemology. And in fact, I know we tend to associate the trivium with stages of a child's development, and that's fine, but that's secondary. First, the trivium is the way that we know and learn, anyone of any age. So as an adult, if I decide I'm going to go out and I'm going to learn Russian, I don't know Russian, where do I start? Well, I start with the alphabet. It's different than my alphabet, so I have to learn that first. I have to learn the alphabet. I have to learn the sounds that it makes. Then I can start some basic vocabulary. This is grammar. This is grammar stage, the basic facts. The next stage we call the dialectic or the rhetoric or the logic stage. The dialectic or the logic stage is starting to put it together. Now I'm starting to put sentences together. I'm starting to have conversations. This is the next stage. Any new subject, you're going to go through these stages. You've got to learn the basic information. Then you have to learn how the basic information fits together. The verbs have to go in a certain place. They have different endings on them. How is it that the syntax of this language works? The rhetoric stage is when you can use the information. In the scriptures, we actually have the trivium, only they call, instead of calling it grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric, they call it knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. If you look through scriptures, you'll see the difference, different meanings of some of those, depending on your translations. But so you have basic knowledge, grammar. You have understanding, putting things together, seeing how they fit, seeing how they relate to one another. That's your logic. And then rhetoric is your wisdom, being able to use it, being able to persuade, being able to create something new that no one's thought before, no one's learned before, no one's heard before. Okay. Another thing to consider is the unity and diversity of knowledge, and this is integration, and this is very important to classical education as well. And that is, though the word is at the center, okay, we need to understand how all these subject areas relate together and are interconnected. Okay, and And to really understand a culture that we're studying in history, we need to look at its art. We need to hear its poetry. To understand the meaning of mathematics, we have to see its echoes in the patterns of nature. We have to see its application to science and technology. And to understand them all, we have to see it all in the light of God's revealed truth. Okay. Now, I wanted to give you some false dichotomies to avoid, bifurcations. Okay. These are things that kind of hang us up, that don't have us thinking biblically about knowledge and learning. And what one is sacred and secular. In some sense, the Reformation really tore down this wall. It used to be in pre-Reformation times that some work was seen as holy work, and then there was other menial work, and so therefore you had holy people and menial people. And so, this whole division, you have the sort of Stoic sort of thing where anything material's got to be bad, and, you know, anything that's holy is out there in the ether somewhere. So we really need to know that there's not a separation of sacred and secular. In our day, well, that was very much broken down in Reformation times, by the way, but that's one of the astounding things when Europeans first came to America, when we were, you know, like Tocqueville's day, you know, was how classless we were as a people, and that, you know, the farmers were reading Blackstone's Law Dictionary, and the, you know, it was more equal in that sense. So the Reformation accomplished a lot in that regard. But in our own day, we're separating sacred and secular in that, well, that applies to you and your church. You go believe that in your church, but don't bring that into the state house. You know, where we want to separate religion from and everything else. So that's where we see it in our day, and we need to be careful that we're not making that true for you, but doesn't work for me, sort of break. Another was similar, a spiritual and material dichotomy. Christ is the embodiment of the union of spiritual and material. Ty kind of talked about that. We talk about our flesh is present in heaven right now. You know, Christ took on our flesh. And, you know, there is a union of the spiritual and the material, and that union is in Christ. Okay, he is God in the flesh. Okay, and we will be resurrected bodily and spiritually. So we can't separate. Another false dichotomy is revealed and discovered information. We tend to separate. I'm not saying there's not revealed and discovered knowledge. There is, of course. But modern philosophy denies the reality of revealed knowledge and restricts us to the discovered, what's discovered through our senses. So that they're not going to accept anything that we know from, they can't prove materially, whatever. Now, another separation of which many of us are guilty is separation of humanities and sciences. So how many are science people, you know, and how many are humanities people? Well, we ought to be whole people, you know. I always considered myself a science person, and now I've sort of discovered in adulthood the beauties of the humanities side. So we need to not make our kids go through decades without one or the other, like we did. So that goes back to the integration again. You know, I was the movie Exposed, Ben Stein. Did you see that? It talks about this about the state of design in science today, and how no one will hear any intelligent design arguments. Well, one of the most interesting comments was. And I can't remember the gentleman's name that he was the historian and philosopher that he was speaking to. But one of the comments he made was that Dawkins is an excellent scientist. He, you know, a lot to say for his ability to do science, but he's a really lousy philosopher. He doesn't understand the tools of philosophy at all. And he's out there making these philosophical arguments, and he's not making them well. And so, you know, I thought, what an interesting comment. And, you know, if we're really going to, and here's a guy who thinks he's all scientist, thinks he's all materialist, but is out there making a philosophical argument, and he's not able to do it well because he doesn't have the tools, again, the rudimentary tools of philosophy. Okay, another false dichotomy is dialectic and poetic. Dialectic being the more reason, logic, sort of understanding, and the poetic knowledge. Poetic knowledge is something that's it's hidden from us a lot, and there's so much of it in Scripture, and we miss it. And as I've gotten older, I've come to realize how much of it we really miss because our culture tends to think rationally too much. How many of you heard sermon on the Good Samaritan? And at the end, the pastor's got to say, well, what it was, this defined neighbor. You know, they have, because the story came from, let me go back, sorry. The story came from Jesus was asked, well, who is my neighbor? He said, love your neighbor as yourself. Well, who is my neighbor? Okay, he was asked a very dialectic sounding question. Well, your neighbor is anybody that you know, he didn't say that. He told a story. You know, he told a story, and he didn't at the end tell what a neighbor was. You know, but why was that the answer? He was speaking poetically. He was giving a poetic understanding. He's saying, okay, you want this dialectic answer to your question, but I'm not going to answer it that way because this is an issue of the heart. I'm going to tell you a story. And at the end, who loved his neighbor? And you know, this is how his story ended. So I think we, in our day, we want to at the end say who the neighbor was, you know, and answer the dialectic question again instead of just absorb the poetic knowledge in the other side of your brain. And so I think we need to make sure that we are not in our curricula, that we're not downgrading that poetic understanding and just focusing on the intellect, on the dialectic. Because that's a tendency of our age. And I think that's something we need to get back. All right, so let's talk about the trivium now in the sense of as a methodology. It does happen that as children develop, they can do rather early on, they can do grammar. But they can't reason logically yet. And so we separate by age group. They're ready for that dialectic stage. You know, varies 7th, 8th grade, 6th maybe. And rhetoric, when it all comes together, they're just not ready for until at least high school. And I think that's really an ability that develops beyond high school. But we need to give them a taste of it at that point. We separate at our school. We kind of think of the grammar in two stages. There's the what we call pre-poly, which is K through 2. In grades K through 2, we're giving foundational learning tools. There's not a lot of fluff in first and second grade or kindergarten for that matter. Basic phonics, they know why there's an E on the end of any word that's got an E on the end of it. They know why it's there. They know all their phonograms. They know the sounds that the letters make and all that. The basic mathematics, numbers, pattern, sequences, adding, subtracting, multiplying, dividing. Very basic. It's a focus there. You do not want them getting to third grade without reading very comfortably and ready for full-fledged grammar school. So grammar school, then we start with, by the way, we teach English grammar starting in first grade also. They know their parts of speech. and all that in first grade. Third grade, and there's a good reason. Third grade, we start Latin. If you don't know the difference between a subject noun and an object noun, you're swimming in Latin. And so they have to have that understanding before they get there. Grammar school, the methods, they sing, they chant, they repeat, they memorize rules. The sound off, are you familiar with the sound off? Okay, the sound off is a big part of the grammar school. Also imitation in writing, imitation in artwork. They do a lot of reciting of beautiful poetry and prose. Okay, by the dialectic stage, now they're ready for formal logic. We teach informal and formal logic to informal fallacies and formal symbolic logic as well. Now the methods in the classroom change. There's a lot more analysis going on. There's a lot more discussion. They categorize, they argue, they debate. Tests got to change as they go up. No longer are they just being tested on grammar. They are tested on grammar. They are the new information they've learned. They have to be able to repeat. But then they have to do something with it. Or this, at the logic stage, they have to be able to compare two things together. So there's a lot of essay-type questions where they're doing a lot more analysis. Also in math, now they're ready for algebra and for geometry as well. Rhetoric stage. Now we need synthesis. Now we need to pull things together from different sources, put together. The research paper at this stage is not just pulling together information from different sources, but pulling together information from different sources and making something new out of it, putting your own ideas in it. So why? So what does this matter? In our school, they do a junior thesis and a senior thesis. You take months to work on it, and they pick the topic their own, and so they're forced to make application of what they're learning in all their classes. And in all this, too, I mentioned again, the training of the affections in all of this, the training them to love this stuff. And you know, you can't force that on anybody. You just love this stuff with them and learn and grow together. And in fact, that's one of the realities of I'll talk more about this in one of my other talks, but, you know, you look around and you see these people who are really on top of things in this classical place, and you think, ooh, I'm way behind them. you know, you're two small baby steps behind them because there's none of us who are – really have this yet. If this is new, we are at step one of a thousand step process here of returning this kind of education to this generation. And I just encourage you, you know, if you're feeling that way, to jump in with both feet and pick up Aristotle. Yes, you can read Aristotle, and you know, you can do this. And So, but love it together, you know, learn together and as you train the affections to love God and see Him in all this stuff. I just want to mention a book, Seven Laws of Teaching. Don't buy this edition. I couldn't find my good one. This is revised. Get one of the unabridged ones. In fact, I think it's available online. I think the text, because it's way out of, you know, this is from, when did he first write this, 1860 to 80-ish. This is a wonderful book, and a lot of the classical schools will use this, of teaching methods. We train all our teachers at our school with this. We go over it again and again every year, and even the teachers have been there for a long time, ask for it. And so John Milton Gregory was a pastor. He wrote this to teach his Sunday school teachers because they weren't professional teachers. And this was to train them to teach in the Sunday schools, in the Sabbath schools. And so this is it's precious. A lot of these rules you're going to read and say, duh. I wish I had time to go. I could do a whole talk just on this book, but I don't have time to do that. But I highly recommend that. Content. Talk a little bit about the content. Christian and Western heritage. Now, why do we say Christian and Western when so much of it is Eastern and pagan? You know, you got to wonder that. You know, why what's important to remember is that God sent Messiah to a Hebrew people living in a Roman world. That's where he sent Messiah. And the gospel went out from there. And so as we understand our own heritage as Christians, you know, I'm mostly, heritage-wise, I'm mostly a Celt. You know, I'm Welsh and Manx. Okay. We don't study Celtic literature in our school, and we wouldn't, because that's not where the flow went. When you think of the flow of history, we had Old Testament people chosen by God. They, as they moved through the world, they came to the point where Messiah came to them in a Roman world, a Greek-speaking world, and we take that Greek heritage and that highly impacted Christianity and as Christianity grew. So that's why we focus on that particular line of history, because the church grew that way. Now the church is, you know, growing throughout the world. But this, you know, this is our heritage, and this is a heritage to all of us, whether it's our ethnic heritage or not. Another reason, another big part of the content is the great conversation. And this goes with that flow of history from the early Greeks. The great conversation, as the ideas and philosophy has developed over time, we call that the great conversation. We want to make our kids a part of that. Up until our generation, most educated people were a part of that flow. They were a part of that, and they understood reason. What did Aristotle have to say about reason? What did Francis Bacon have to say about reason? You know, what's the difference? What's the difference between Aristotle's logic and Bacon's logic? How did these things develop over time? And all the great ideas we need to follow, you know, through history, and we want to make our kids a part of that great conversation ourselves. A weakness in our time is that we fail to regard any other time. This has contributed to widespread ignorance and a decline in public discourse. Scriptures model for us the importance of remembering. They were constantly setting up memorials. You know, remember what God did here. Remember what he did there. Okay. And God has worked out his purposes through history of his people from creation through Israel in the flow of Western civilization. And through that process, he stored up for us a rich heritage of the great conversation of Western thought. And familiarity with the development of human thought prepares one to contribute to that conversation. We desire to equip our students to use and enjoy that treasure and contribute to the heritage of their children. Okay. Now, one question that often gets asked at this point is, why study the stuff that isn't true? Okay, you know, read Homer, and it's not all true, right? So, you know, why are we studying these things that aren't true? And many of these ideas that we study, you know, our kids read Darwin. You know, they read it quite thoroughly and discuss it quite a bit. You know, why read it if we don't think it's true? But I love a quote. This is Mortimer Adler. Mortimer Adler has an essay in the Great Books. There's a collection, a set of books, Great Books of the Western World, and there's a little reader's guide in there with essays in it, and this is from that. Mortimer Adler says, on any subject being considered, the relation between truth and error is that of one to many. The truth is always singular, while the errors it corrects are manifold. This fact should not be thought as invidious to the worth of reading the great books. On the contrary, it is of the greatest importance. No truth is well understood until and unless all the errors it corrects are also understood, and all the contradictions found are resolved. It is in the context of a plurality of errors to be corrected and of contradictions to be resolved that the brilliance of the truth shines out and illumines the scene. There's a lovely quote and tells us why it is we bother reading all this stuff that's wrong. Okay, I do want to leave some time for questions, but let me quickly talk about content I went over this a little bit. Grammar. We want to be sure we're covering phonics. ACCS, by the way, requires that it be phonics. English and Latin grammar. English and Latin vocabulary. Composition. Number sense and arithmetic. Literature, Bible survey, and memorizing all the books, all the tribes, all the disciples, all the this is a great time for memorizing, kind of. Memorizing scripture and the catechism, if you use a catechism. A framework of history. We use Veritas's history is sort of a guideline, as the cards that they have, because it builds a timeline in their mind that they'll be able to hang things to later. I see now the fruit of that in our upper school, they want to hook events to other events and in their mental timeline. It's very, very useful to build that somehow. Science, classification, and vocabulary. And get them to love it. Get them, let them out there discover. And, one of the things that John Milton Gregory talks a lot about is you don't have students. You don't tell them anything they can't discover for themselves. Help them discover it rather than tell it to them. So as much of that as you can do. And science is a great place for that, even in the grammar school. And also presentation and speaking of prepared material in the grammar school. So let them memorize poems and present them. Learn to read a passage very well and read it aloud for an audience. Oral reports. But they need to be doing that sort of grammar stage rhetoric if that's not a contradiction in terms. Dialectic stage, you need to learn logic. They need to be learning the how and the why of history, not just the facts. They need to learn and practice self-consciously analytical reading. Talk about what you're thinking as you're reading. Why, learn how to pre-read a book, how to find out its structure and its framework and its purpose before you read it, those kind of skills. Mortimer Adler has a book, How to Read a Book. If you haven't read that book, read that book. It seems silly title, I know. But it's one that changed my life, that book. It really did. It told me that I didn't know how to read. I thought I did, but I didn't. I couldn't find my copy to bring with me, and I it's so worn and old, and I reread it every couple of years. Okay, let's see, where were we? Oh, dialectic, yeah. They should be doing lots of comparing and contrasting, analyzing arguments, constructing arguments, debate. And you can have debates in your classroom for just as part of your classroom discussion. Okay, this half of the class, take this side. This half class, take this side. Let them huddle together, come together, and have a debate. Not just in debate class, I mean in history class, in different classes, literature class. All right. Integration of fields, making connections. They should see how religion influences politics and how it influences art, how science and technology influence history, those things. Okay, rhetoric, stage. Avoid specializing too soon. Like we said before, we need to get the tools of all the major disciplines as part of the curriculum. If you're specializing too soon, they're focusing only. I took 7 science classes in my 4 years of high school. You know, I doubled up the last year. You know, it's not right. It's not right. We need to have a broader range. So I'd encourage you, even when students have inclinations in a certain area, that's great. But don't specialize too soon. Don't give up other things for it. Introduce the master level tools of all the disciplines. I talked about that before. When, you know, what do historians do? What other than teach? What does a PhD historian do other than teach? Yeah. Okay. All right. Although being able to teach is a rhetoric level skill too. Okay, and try to understand historical events according to the philosophical framework of the place and time in which they happened. That's a very important part of the rhetoric, is the understanding of worldview. We also teach, as far as Bible goes, in the dialectic stage, we teach church history, so they can get a sense of that, and we teach it mostly from the point of view of the heresies, the councils and the heresies, and, you know, bring them through so they can see the development of Christian thought through the years. In the rhetoric school, they learn hermeneutics and apologetics and systematic theology. So, okay, that's what I have, and I've got about 10 minutes for questions. If there's things we want to ask or talk about. Anybody? Becky?
Talking about that dialectic, the first stage, and the need for debate, and I would assume that how many here are actually homeschoolers? So they don't have a classroom setting. What would you recommend as an alternative? Unless, you know, they're considering Blackburn, which I don't know, but so what would you recommend for homeschoolers who don't have that opportunity?
Yeah, there's one is debate, Mom. you can always do that. Take opposite sides, and that's one. I would recommend you get together with other kids that age, and do some swapping. Now, I was actually homeschooling at that age. And there was other homeschoolers in the neighborhood, and we got together and did a lot of our courses together. So, yeah, there is a need. Now, there's also discussion groups and things online. There's a lot of really high-quality literature discussion groups out there. You got to find them, but they're you know, they are available to help. We had another question? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay. I'm not from this area, so I don't. Yeah. So that's another suggestion. Yeah, it's a good thing to start. I mean, if you're got a group, you know, in your church, if you got a core group or in your neighborhood that homeschool, then that's a good. It's a good age to get them together. Yeah. Anything else?
I mean, not knowing a whole lot about the program because we're new, is maybe you could just speak to the essence of the distinction of when someone's coming out of the secular public school systems, you know, transitioning into college, you know, and parents were thinking about being able to get into college, first of all, get into a good college, and also be able to do some vocation out there. It'd be great to just think all day, but you eventually have to do something. Sort of a broad question, but maybe you could speak to the distinction of coming out of this environment, this type of environment, to accomplish those goals versus what, you know, is going on in most of our society.
Yeah, that's a very good question, and that's a concern that a lot of people have, especially when they've got sons, and you know, we want them to be heading a family and making a living, and is is he going to be able to do that with this very general? What we've seen is that our kids leaving our schools seem to have no trouble getting into secular colleges, you know, if that's their choice. A lot of them choose Christian colleges and continue. But, you know, we've got one at up here, Penn State, in the, you know, in honors engineering program. We've got, you know, they my own son's at a secular university. They have no problem. In fact, most of them find it easier than, because they haven't been learning just spitting back stuff all the time, that when they get to college and they have to write papers and all that, our kids, our graduates keep coming back and saying, they made me peer tutor for writing. They made me peer, and we look and say, you? You know? We don't say that out loud. No, but but even our average Midland students are much better writers than their peers in college. And most important is that they're able to think. They're able to process the information so that, you know, they didn't have the snazzy chemistry lab, you know, at our school that, you know, we'd like to have. But they go on and they do great in chemistry. They're because the mind is trained. And then they're able to pick up any. I feel the same way about computers. Yeah, we do have computers, and we have a keyboarding class to teach them to type. You know, Mavis Beacon teaches it. We don't. But we don't teach a lot of computer stuff, but these kids all go pick that stuff up anyway. It's because they're taught to think logically. They can process mathematics well, they can process science well, they can think, they can do papers. My own son was one of those Midland students, and he is at Temple now, and when he first got back, he's like, Mom, everybody's all upset about this paper we have to write. It's only 5 pages. You know, it's like, what are they, so a lot of these kids coming out from other schools are not able to process, not able to write the way they are. And these kids can learn anything. They could just go learn what they need to learn because they have the tools.
It's given a huge wealth of books and knowledge within the Western tradition in the limited amount of time you have in high school. How do you really evaluate what books are profitable for?
That's another excellent question. might be surprised at this answer, but it doesn't matter. And it really, the content doesn't matter as much as the process. That's, which is why I favor doing less deeper than covering a lot lightly. I know there's a lot of programs out there where they want to do a little bit of this, a little bit of this, a little bit. You want to give them a broad familiarity with what is out there, but give them time to delve deeply, higher level, higher rhetoric level in fewer things. So you really don't have to cover the entire Western canon. You don't have to do all 64 volumes of great books of the Western world. You know, you got a lifetime to do that. But you need to give them, one thing, get over the intimidation factor that they've got the courage to go there and pick up these books that they've never read and know, you know, have the confidence that they can handle it. But to cover every great book out there, we just can't do it. I mean, even as a lifetime doesn't seem long enough. You know, I'm hoping to have a great book set in heaven, but I don't know. They will have a whole time to get through the whole thing. But so I that would be my answer, is that it doesn't matter so much what you cover, but just that you delve. Dorothy Sayers, in her essay on the lost tools of learning, talks about that. She talks about, being able to really chew on it and digest it, and it not really mattering so much what it is you're chewing and digesting. So I would say, to be your guideline, to look at those major fields again, look at those major fields of study, and give them experience with the tools in all the fields, and not worry that they don't know everything about it.
A little plug-in for your 1:30 session.
There you go.
Talking about your great books.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, you were talking about the pre-poly, K through 2.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a curriculum that you recommend, or Just being completely new with this.
I can tell you what we use, but for phonics, we use a program. Let's see, they keep changing the name. Spell to Write and Read. It's a wonderful phonics program. It's supposed to be used through from K to 5. We teach cursive, by the way, right from the beginning. If you have any sort of dyslexic tendencies, especially, it's the cursive just removes all that. So it's a I like the reason I like that program, and there's other good phonics programs out there. I won't say it's the only one, but the reason I like that one is because the rules really do apply. When I was English makes more sense. I was shocked to learn. I was in my 30s when I learned this phonics system, and I learned so much about my native language. When I was a kid, like it was two vowels go walking, the first one does the talking. It doesn't. You know, look at the word great. you know, and when there's an E on the end, it makes the vowel say its name, right? Well, what about love? What about castle? You know, and then there's all these rules that break the rules. This system really teaches them all the rules, and it gives them five reasons why an E might be at the end of a word. And they understand what they all are. And by the our first graders know why there's an E on the end of castle, and you know, so I like that system. We use Saxon math through grammar school. Saxon is an excellent grammar school math. When it gets higher, it continues grammar methods, and so we think it's not appropriate for middle school and high school. Seventh grade uses it, and then eighth grade we switch. We use Jacob's algebra and geometry, and I can't remember what pre-calculus we use. Let's see, what else do you need? History, I said we use Veritas history. Science, we do our own. We do, we've developed unit studies for science, but science doesn't have a real prominent place in the pre-poly. Bible, they do surveys, Bible stories. They memorize the books of the Bible. They learn to find passages in the Bible. They memorize certain things like the tribes and the disciples and things like that. They learn the Apostles' Creed, the Lord's Prayer, the Catechism. We use Catechism. We use the Westminster Shorter Catechism through 12th grade, really. Yes? Wanda Senseri is the author. It's Spell to Write and Read. Senseri, I think. S-A-N-S-E-R-I?
Yeah.
I really love that program. Now, the downside of it is you kind of have to get trained to teach it. You can just read the books, but it's better to go to a training. But then there's no books. You know, other than the teacher's manual, there's no books, and my time's up. So it's an inexpensive one to use. Once you've gone through that training, you get 5 years of instruction, and you just have to buy a new composition book every year. Okay, thank you.